6. A new day arrived in Atlantis in its usual idiosyncratic manner. On land or the surface of the sea, dawn starts as a glowing sliver of orange on the horizon that slowly grows until the sun is fully exposed and the land is bathed with light. But Atlantis was built on the inside curve of a gigantic bowl, which floated in the Mediterranean, all but its rim submerged below the waterline. So sunrise presented in Atlantis as a diffuse orange glow in the sky, followed by a thin line of direct sunlight along the inside edge of the city's western rim. Every day in Atlantis started in a pleasant haze of adequate but diffuse light, which made for cooler temperatures and less severe hangovers. As the bright line of daylight starting, slowly oozing its way down the wall of western Atlantis, Britt the Younger and Philip were just sitting down to breakfast. The two of them had not moved in together, because they didn't have to move. They were wizards, and had the option of simply creating two permanent portals, leading from Philip's rustic hut on the edge of Ledchurch and his office and 80s-themed game room in the middle of Ledchurch proper, directly into the living room of Britt's tastefully decorated minimalist apartment in Atlantis, 2,000 miles away and nearly 1,500 years earlier in time. This arrangement gave them each the illusion of independence, along with a combined two-bedroom, three-bathroom home with ocean and pastoral views, in a convenient downtown location, in two different towns, with generous entertainment space, a home office, a garage, and a mind-bendingly confusing time zone shift that served as a constant source of conversation. They took their meals at Britt's because she had a nice table, dishes, flatware, and Nick, a devoted servant who made meals that were healthier and more aesthetically presented than the food Philip prepared with his stew pot or magically pulled out of his hat. They were both picking over their last few bites of breakfast when they heard quiet knocking and anguished shouting in the distance. Philip and Britt both rose to their feet. Nick stepped in from the kitchen. All three of them listened to the sounds for a moment. Then Philip and Britt approached the two portals to Philip's time. They both opened the rustic wooden doors and stuck their heads into the portals, then pulled their heads back out. Philip said,
"I've got the shouting."
Britt said, "I've got the knocking." Philip said,
"I'll go see what the shouting's about."
Britt crowded past Philip and darted into the door he had checked.
"No way, the shouting sounds much more interesting. I'll take it. You take the knocking."
Nick said,
"And I'll do the dishes."
"Good, we have a plan. Now break."
Britt closed the door behind her, leaving Philip no choice but to enter the door she had checked, the one with the quiet knocking. Philip emerged from the portal in the room above his office. He quickly but carefully walked around the early 80s bachelor pad decor, the vintage Gorf machine, and his pride and joy, the immaculate Pontiac Fiero. He nearly ran down the stairs, through his seance room, and into his front office, a small space stuffed with mysterious-looking powders, salves, and curios, none of which served any purpose beyond looking mysterious. As he approached the door, the knocking remained quiet, but took on a more urgent tone through its rapid delivery and shaky cadence. Philip opened the door, said,
"Yes, Hubert, what can I?"
Then stepped out into the street. Hubert, his eyes wide with panic, lurched behind Philip into the open door to the shop, ducked around the side of the doorframe for cover, and whispered,
"Master Wizard, sir, we have a problem."
Philip said,
"Yes,"
shutting down any further explanation. He knew all too well what he was looking at, but for the moment he had no idea what to do about it. He heard the high-pitched warbling tone that told him another wizard wanted to communicate with him. He lifted his left hand as if he was examining a bowling ball just before trying to make a 7-10 split. In the empty space above his hand, he saw a ghostly image of a letter B that rotated and morphed into a letter T, then a letter Y. He answered the call and heard Britt the Younger's voice.
"Phil, I'm at your hut. I think you'd better see this."
Philip said,
"I can see it."
One of the few advantages of having your town get overrun by a small herd of dragons is that dragons are large enough to see, even from a distance. Many miles away, Martin sat in his warehouse at his table alone, eating his breakfast while talking with Gwen, who was not there. Instead, a real-time image of her head floated over Martin's table so that they could make eye contact and talk like civilized adults while they ate their respective breakfasts. Mostly, they talked about where they might go for lunch. Gwen, like almost all female wizards, lived in Atlantis. Martin lived in Camelot, which sounded just as exotic as Atlantis until you learned that Camelot was just London, renamed by a wizard named Jimmy during a bout of temporary megalomania.
"Let's just go to the cafe here near my place," Gwen said.
"We always go there. I'm tired of it." Martin pulled a bottle of syrup out of his hat and poured it on his waffles.
"Do you eat waffles for breakfast every day?"
"Yep."
"Why?" "You can pull anything you want out of your hat."
"Exactly. I can have anything I want, so I make waffles every day. There's no better way to start the day than with fresh hot waffles, slathered in butter with syrup squeezed from a plastic bottle shaped like an old lady, just as nature intended."
"Why not just create the waffles pre-syrupped? You'd save a step."
"Tried it. If my hands shake even a little bit, I end up with a sticky hat."
"Whatever. Look, let's just go to the cafe. We always go there because it's always good."
"Well, maybe I'm tired of good."
"So you'd rather eat somewhere you know will be bad?"
"I'm not saying that. It's just, it might be nice to eat somewhere here in Camelden."
"So you do want to eat somewhere you know will be bad? Martin, food in Atlantis is made to modern standards. Food in medieval England, not so much."
"Gwen, we can eat here without eating here now. We're time travelers. Let's act like it. How about I take you to lunch in London in the mid-60s? Piccadilly Circus at the height of the mod scene? It'll be like living in the first 5 minutes of an Austin Powers movie."
Gwen thought for a moment, then said, "That may be the best idea you've ever had. I'll need to find something appropriate to wear."
"What about me?"
"Your silver robe should fit right in."
The wavering tone that denoted someone calling them sounded. He looked at the image of Gwen and saw a second, smaller image of Philip's face looking angry, which meant it was urgent. Martin warned Gwen, then conferenced Philip in. Martin said, "Hey, Philip, you've got Gwen and I. What's up?"
Philip said, "It's Gwen and me, and we've got a problem. Many problems, big problems, many big problems. I need one of you to call the gang and get them all to come to Leadchurch. We need help."
Gwen said,
"Well, I'll have to make the calls, because Martin's probably already there with you by now."
Martin said, "Hey, Philip." Philip turned to his right and saw Martin standing next to him in front of his shop in Leadchurch.
"What's going on there? Everyone's going to ask when I call them."
Martin said,
"Dragons! The town is overrun with dragons!"
There were two dragons in the street in front of Philip's shop. They didn't seem angry or even upset. If anything, they seemed curious. One peered through windows and poked its head under awnings. The other walked down the street slowly, moseying, really, looking at the buildings as it went. The dragons walked on all fours, but the front two of the four had been adapted into wings instead of legs. This gave the dragon's gait a clumsy, labored quality. The dragons were calm and quiet. The people, on the other hand, were terrified and quiet. They huddled in corners, hid behind barrels and wagons, anything large enough to block the dragon's view. As soon as a dragon turned its back, the people behind it would silently dart into the nearest open door. Most of the buildings were only one or two stories tall, so the dragons poked up above the rooftops. Martin could see two more dragons from where he stood. He glanced out toward the edge of town and saw Britt the Younger hovering above the rooftops. She looked right at him and gave an exaggerated, confused shrug. Gwen remained sitting in her home in Atlantis and could think a little more rationally than the others.
Why didn't you call Jeff first?
Martin said,
She's got a point.
Philip gritted his teeth.
Right. I'll call Jeff. Please call everyone else, then come here. Hopefully by then we'll have a plan.
Gwen hung up. Martin said,
This is something, isn't it?
Yes, Philip said. It's safe to say that this situation definitely qualifies as being, as you say, something.
Philip called Jeff. After a moment of ringing Jeff's logo, a simple picture of Jeff's face, clearly taken himself just to have something to use as a logo, appeared. A sleepy voice said,
Hello?
Philip said,
Dragons, Jeff! Downtown Leadchurch is overrun by dragons. Your dragons.
Jeff no longer sounded sleepy.
What? No way!
I'm afraid so.
No, there's no way they could have escaped.
They must have.
Are you sure they're dragons? Have you seen them yourself?
I'm looking at them right now.
Well, they must have gotten out, I guess. I'll go take a look at the pen.
Martin rolled his eyes, and Philip shook his head while they waited for Jeff to confirm what they already knew. Jeff shouted,
No way! You say my dragons are there with you?
Yes, Philip said. I assume they are not in your pen?
After a heavy silence, Jeff said,
I'll be right there.
Yes, I expect you will.
Philip turned to Martin and said,
Jeff'll be right here.
Jeff materialized, looked up at the dragons, who were still peacefully exploring the street, and shouted,
No way!
Philip turned to Martin and said,
Jeff's here.
Martin asked,
How'd they escape?
Jeff said,
We can discuss that later. Right now we should just concentrate on getting the dragons out of here.
Martin nodded and said,
I'll take that to mean I don't know.
Roy appeared, looked alarmed, then asked Jeff what went wrong. Tyler appeared and followed the same procedure as Roy. Gary turned up last and just giggled while pointing, first at the dragons, then at Jeff, then at the frightened locals. Gwen arrived last, having called everyone else before rushing to the scene herself, and they discussed their options. Martin said,
What's the big deal? Jeff just zapped them back to their cage.
Philip said,
No, don't. We mustn't give the locals the idea that we are too powerful. We want them to respect us, not be terrified of us. Also, if Jeff banishes the dragons like he's flipping a light switch, they might get the idea he created the threat to begin with.
Yeah,
Jeff nearly shouted.
Yeah, that's a bad move. I won't do that.
Fine,
Gary said.
So we kill the dragons right here and Jeff makes more. One second, I'll get my machine guns.
Gwen said,
No, don't. These people are on edge already. We don't want to cause a panic. I say we shoo the dragons out of town, then deal with them away from any spectators.
Gwen's right,
Roy said.
Heck, running away is all these dragons are good for anyway.
Jeff said, Hey, that's not fair. Britt said,
Isn't it?
She took three steps toward the nearest dragon, which sent it flying into the sky. They watched to see what direction it flew, but the dragon circled, not seeming to feel threatened, or at least not threatened enough to want to stray too far from the other dragons.
Okay,
Philip said.
That worked a treat. I say we rouse the other dragons, then when they're in the air we chase them off and eliminate them away from town. Agreed?
Everyone agreed, in a non-committal sort of way. As they split up to walk through the streets and startle the dragons, Gary said,
Okay, Jeff, how many dragons were there total?
It doesn't matter. The dragons that are here. We can do a census later, okay?
The wizards fanned out, walking cautiously street by street. They knew that the dragons couldn't actually harm them or anyone. They were computer-generated puppets. They looked and felt real, but their claws would go right through you like a painful ghost, and their fiery breath felt blistering hot but would not cause burns.
The chief danger was that one of the dragons would panic and step on someone, or accidentally knock a wall over on them. The wizard's caution was mostly caused by a psychological response to the dragon's intimidating size, the palpable fear of the citizens who watched from the buildings all around them, and Jeff muttering, "Slowly, be careful," over the battle comm. A second dragon took to the air, followed by a third and a fourth. They made good progress until Gwen called out, "Hey, Jeff, why did you give this one horns?"
"What?"
Jeff said in that gasping, hoarse voice that people make when they attempt to shout a whisper.
"What do you mean, horns?"
"Yeah," Roy shouted. "What do you mean?"
Gwen said,
"This one's got big, curved horns."
The wizards converged on Gwen's location, and sure enough, they saw a large, light gray dragon with two impressive spiraling horns sprouting from its head.
"Why'd you give this one horns?"
Tyler asked as Jeff joined the group.
"Yeah,"
Roy asked.
"Why, Jeff?"
Jeff moaned.
"Oh, no way."
"It's really cool. That's reason enough," Martin said, walking slowly toward the horned dragon.
Jeff said,
"Martin, hang back a second."
Martin said,
"Why? They can't hurt us."
Roy looked at Jeff and said,
"He's right, isn't he?"
Jeff said,
"Yeah, of course, I think."
Martin drew closer. In the sky above town, the four dragons that had already been shooed circled. The horned dragon watched Martin approach and slowly lowered its head.
"See?"
Martin said.
"I think it wants me to pet it. I'll chase it off."
Martin ran two steps, an act which sent the previous dragons flying. The horned dragon chose instead to charge directly at Martin, ramming him with its wrecking ball-sized head and massive horns, pushing him backwards until they both struck the side of a house. Martin's torso provided a cushion that prevented the dragon's massive head from striking the wall, but all of the dragon's force carried through him and still did quite a bit of damage. Martin let out a pained cough. Jeff shouted, indistinct, alarmed vowel sounds, as if he needed to speak but was at a loss for words. Roy offered,
"No way."
"I know, right?"
Gary said.
"Now it attacks."
Jeff ran forward. Martin crouched on the ground in front of the wall, which now bore a Martin-shaped dent. The dragon backed up several steps, lowered its head again, and was about to ram again when Jeff leapt between the dragon and Martin and used his wand to emit a blinding flash of light. The dragon reared back, confused.
"Martin!"
Jeff shouted.
"Do your thing!"
"What?"
Martin asked.
"Be big! Grow up! Get swole! I don't know what you call it, just do it now!"
"You want me to trigger my macro?"
The dragon shook its head vigorously, then regained its bearings and lowered its head, preparing to ram both Martin and Jeff in one run.
"Yes, that, now!"
Martin did as he was asked, quickly dissolving into a cloud of silver boxes that exploded outward, swirled around in a large cloud, then coalesced into a new silver Martin that stood 30 feet tall. The dragon looked up from its ramming stance, realized that it now faced a much larger adversary than before, and chose to flee. It soared into the air and joined the other four dragons flying circles in the sky high above the city. Tyler looked up at the dragons and said,
"Let's see. If Jeff made 7, and we've accounted for 5, that means there are 2 still lurking around."
"Yes,"
Roy said.
"If. I'm curious, Jeff. Why don't you just delete the dragons?"
"I can't."
"Can't because there's a good reason not to, or can't because it's not possible?"
Britt moaned. Philip asked,
"What are you getting at, Roy? These aren't the dragons Jeff made. They're still safe and sound in that geodesic dome you made for them, aren't they?"
Jeff said, "I made these dragons too, just
not deliberately. The ones I made deliberately are back in the cage, Philip said.
Jeff, you're telling us that you created extra dragons by accident?
Gary said,
it happens.
Roy said,
no, it doesn't. Or at least it shouldn't. What happened, Jeff? Did you cut some corner? Take a little shortcut, did you?
What I did isn't important right now.
Britt said, it's very important. Just not quite as important as the small herd of dragons circling over town.
Will it remain a small herd, Jeff?
Roy asked. I hope so.
Britt said, that's not a good answer.
No matter, Philip said. Right now, these dragons are our problem. And luckily, I have a way to deal with them.
Philip lifted his staff above his head and flew into the sky above town.
Does he have a way to deal with them, Jeff?
Roy asked. I hope so.
Britt scowled and said,
that's still not a good answer.
Philip gained altitude until he drew level with the dragons. He found the one with the horns, the largest and most aggressive dragon. He intended to deal with it first. Philip prepared his missile spell, locked the targeting system onto the horned dragon, and fired. There was no actual physical missile, just a ball of bright, pulsing light that tracked its target using the aiming algorithm from a video game. The pulse of light streaked through the sky. The horned dragon saw it coming and turned in an effort to evade. The missile struck the dragon in the side and exploded with an artificially generated blinding flash and the all-too-real force of several sticks of dynamite, enough power to reduce a car to a smoking ruin. The dragon was shoved off course, but suffered no damage. Britt rounded angrily on Jeff.
Why?
They aren't real, Jeff explained miserably. They're not real animals. They're non-player characters, avatars, simulations. Unless they're programmed to react to something, they won't. Shooting one with a weapon they aren't programmed for and hoping it'll kill them is like insulting a mannequin and hoping to hurt its feelings.
Didn't you program them to be killed by missiles?
Tyler asked. No, I didn't. I haven't done any custom programming on these dragons. I didn't know these dragons existed, and even with the other dragons, half of the time I just had to watch what you guys did and decide whether or not to count it as a knockout and trigger the kill animation.
Well then, what are you waiting for?
Gary asked.
Kill these off already.
Roy said,
he can't.
Jeff shook his head. I don't have any direct interface with these dragons.
Why not?
Tyler asked.
Because he didn't create them,
Roy said.
He has no idea how they came to exist.
That means that he doesn't know where their entries are in the file, and his control program doesn't have any hooks into their code. They're completely autonomous. Poorly programmed, but autonomous.
Well, can't we just make them vanish anyway?
Gary asked.
Like we do with the cockroaches we find in our homes?
Britt asked, you do that?
You don't?
I don't have cockroaches in my home.
Well, aren't you fancy?
Too risky,
Roy said, straining his words through gritted teeth.
We don't know how they appeared, so we don't know what process they somehow got tied to. If we make them disappear, we don't know what else might disappear along with them.
Gary said,
that sucks.
I know it sucks, Jeff shouted. I'm painfully aware that it sucks. I'll be happy to have an in-depth discussion about the suckage later. But right now we have dragons circling overhead, freaking out the locals.
They're not circling anymore, Martin said, shielding his eyes as he looked to the sky.
They're all chasing Philip.
Philip flew in large, lazy curves. Just fast enough that the horned dragon couldn't quite catch him. It followed every move he made, and the other four dragons followed both of them. As the wizard stood and watched the dragon's pursuit of Philip,
many of the citizens slowly began to peek their heads out of their hiding places, some lured by the relative quiet, others drawn by the sound of the wizards arguing. Gwen asked,
Jeff, if these dragons aren't programmed to react to our weapon spells, is it possible that they also aren't programmed to not respond to our usual defensive spells?
Jeff took a moment to decipher Gwen's double negative, then said,
I hope so.
Britt said,
We haven't had a lot of luck with that response today, but it's worth a try.
She pressed her thumb and ring finger together to trigger the battle communications macro and said,
Philip, there's a chance our defensive spells might work. Try throwing up an exclusion field behind you. Let's see if it stops them.
Philip turned around to face the dragons and muttered,
Mura rapida,
Esperanto for quick wall, to create an exclusion field, an invisible barrier through which no living thing aside from himself could pass. His speed dropped as he watched the horned dragon approach the invisible wall, reach it, and pass through as if it weren't there. Philip waited a bit too long to continue fleeing. He couldn't see the invisible force field, so it took him an extra second to convince himself that it hadn't worked. When he finally got up to speed, the horned dragon was only a few yards behind him. He could have outrun the dragons easily, of course, or simply teleported away. He hadn't, because as long as the dragons kept chasing him, they were, to some extent, under his control. He could simply lead them around by the nose for as long as he wanted, unless something happened to upset the balance of power. The horned dragon opened its jaws and exhaled a scorching jet of whitish-yellow flames, which fully enveloped Philip. The rest of the wizards had watched the entire sequence of events unfold. As Philip's startled, pained yelp reached their ears, Martin asked,
Is this what it's like to watch me?
Usually,
Gwen answered. The dragon reached the end of its lung capacity. The fireball dissipated. Philip was gone. The wizards were only puzzled for a moment before they heard coughing behind them. Philip had teleported out of the fireball and was standing behind them. The program that gave the wizards their powers also manipulated their entries in the repository file to make them impervious to physical damage, so none of them had any doubt that Philip was all right. Gary said,
Good thing the fire can't hurt you, eh?
Harm!
Philip coughed.
The fire didn't harm me. I assure you, it hurt quite a lot.
Tyler said,
Yeah, well, that's how Jeff programmed them. It hurts, but it's not real fire. It won't burn anything.
Yeah, Jeff said. That's right. I mean, Philip, could you tell? It's the fake fire I programmed. Not real fire, right?
Philip narrowed his eyes and asked Jeff,
Why are you asking me?
An excellent question, Britt said, and one we'll have to table for now.
She pointed to the dragons. They flew in a loose formation with the horned dragon in the lead. It seemed to have seen where Philip went. It brought the others down the street toward the wizards at just above rooftop level, with great speed and ominous intent. The knowledge that one has unnatural powers does not quite trump one's natural instincts. The wizards started running away from the dragons before taking to the air. As they ran, Gary asked,
Jeff, how'd you get them to act so lifelike?
By doing something stupid,
Jeff said.